I'd like to welcome everyone to today's CHAIT Partnership Call, which we've titled Radiation and Human Health in the Shadow of the Japan Disaster. Our moderator today is Steve Heilig, Director of Public Health and Education at the San Francisco Medical Society, as well as at CHAIT. We have set up a blog in association with today's call. You can post comments or questions on the blog, and we will do our best to get to all of them. To get to the blog, you go to the CHAIT homepage at healthandenvironment.org. Select the call link from the left-hand box, and then you can follow that link to the blog. We have also posted a number of resources under the background information link on the call page for today's call. Everyone has been muted, with the exception of our speakers and our moderator. At the end of the conversation, we will open up the call for a Q&A session. This call is scheduled to last for an hour. It is being recorded, and an MP3 file will be available for downloading on the CHAIT website soon. And we hope you enjoy the call this morning. And with that, I will turn it back over to you, Steve.
Thank you very much, Erica. And good day to everybody. I believe we have quite a few people on today, and that's not surprising given the topic and the current events. So just very briefly, I would just say that obviously the issue of risk to human health from radiation related to nuclear energy in particular have been hotly debated for many decades. And in more recent years, it's become influenced quite a bit by concerns about climate change and the ever-growing need for cleaner forms of energy. So it's not a new issue, but the March 11th earthquake, tsunami, and reactor tragedy in Japan have heightened many concerns. Every time there is an incident such as this, or any kind of major disaster, many questions come up regarding what the extent of exposures are and what the impacts might be, and how much we really know about exposure at various levels and proximities, and how safe reactors and other potential related exposures such as nuclear waste are, and then the usual concerns that we have on these kind of calls with CHAIT about how solid is the science and who is most trustworthy and how to minimize and prevent exposures. So we're very lucky and grateful to have two really leading speakers here today on this call. And we're going to start with Dr. Arjun Makajani, who is president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research and is highly trained in the field of nuclear fusion and nuclear energy from UC Berkeley, author of many studies and books, and is going to start us off today giving us his perspective on some of these issues. And then, of course, we will have a discussion after the two presentations. So, Dr. Makajani, please go ahead.
Thank you. I go for about 10 minutes.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay. Let me just give you my perspective on what is going on. All of you have been following the accident, I'm sure. This is unprecedented in a number of ways, the most important of which is I don't believe that there's ever been imagined that seven major sources of radioactivity would be in crisis and need management at the same time, at the same site. And the other aspect, of course, is in the middle of larger-scale destruction of infrastructure, of roads, of fuel, and a large number of people being already in shelters from reasons other than the nuclear crisis. So this has rewritten the book on what can be imagined, because I'm not aware that any accident scenario like this was written as possible, but certainly in the future we will have to think about it. The things that immediately came to my attention was besides the reactors, which lost cooling, and the reason you need to cool these reactors is this is like a pressure cooker with the heat on the inside, and the heat comes from radioactivity, and if there's a meltdown, the volatile elements, cesium-137, 134, iodine-131, as well as the gases, vent, if they're not contained, as has been the case here. And severity of the accident is judged by, you know, the scale of the radiation releases, obviously. That's one. And the other thing that's unique about this is each of these reactors had a spent fuel pool in them. We have reactors in this country that have more spent fuel than spent fuel in their pools than all four reactors combined, like the Vermont Yankee plant in Vermont, which has more than 600 tons of spent fuel. And I think in this case, there's 500 and odd tons in these four reactors, roughly speaking, the exact number slips my mind right now. And spent fuel also has to be kept cool. Damages from spent fuel pool accidents in the United States have been judged potentially to be very large by a Brookhaven study in 1997. That's the reason I called attention to this problem. The first thing that I understood on March 14th, and there's an evaluation of spent fuel pool issues is on our website. The total releases of radioactivity have been estimated by various people so far, including the French authorities, and I find their stuff to be quite reliable, unlike after Chernobyl, where they said no radioactivity passed over France, and then after a number of years when it was shown to be wrong, they look very, very bad. This time they're being very proactive, and I think issuing very credible assessments of the accident, updated every day. Their assessment was that iodine-131 has reached over 2 million curies, 2.4 million curies. Chernobyl is variously assessed officially by the Soviets at 7 million and odd curies, but that was undoubtedly an underestimate, probably by a factor of 3. So about 10% of Chernobyl releases. Others, the Austrian Meteorological Organization has, using comprehensive test ban treaty data, assessed the releases at a much higher level and pushing comparison with Chernobyl by now. The problem right now is, of course, this accident is not at all under control, and in the last few days, the indications are not good because the turbine buildings have highly radioactive water, they're dark, they have no lights, and electricity for routine cooling cannot be reconnected. The salt is probably deposited on these fuel rods. The fuel rods in 3 reactors are damaged. The other thing is the 4th spent fuel pool, where the reactor was down for maintenance, contains all of the active fuel from the reactor as well. So that spent fuel pool that had a hydrogen explosion is probably the most troublesome because also contains fresh fuel with short-lived radionuclides. And as you all know, iodine-131, of course, will go to the thyroid, and I'll let Ira deal with that. But the Japanese government has published radiation dose isoplets, and they have said that if you look at the map, they assess that if an infant were 24 hours outside, that the inhalation dose could produce within the 20 to 30 kilometer area where people were suggested to go outside the evacuation zone, produce doses between certainly over 10 rem and maybe up to 50 rem. And but that, of course, is not an actual dose because of 2 reasons. It's an underestimate because it doesn't include food and milk, and it's an overestimate because it assumes 24-hour outside presence. The overall total dose that I can infer from inhalation to adults would be, given the circumstances, quite low, much, much lower, 2 orders of magnitude lower, or 3. So maybe I'll stop there, and so that there can be a maximum amount of time for questions. Oh, one more thing. The cesium amount emitted seems to be also about 10 or 20% of the Chernobyl accident, depending on whose estimates you're willing to believe. In the long term, this accident is not likely to be brought under control anytime soon, and it's going to be a mess for years.
Okay, we will have probably some questions and answers on the meaning of mess after this. So thank you. Thank you very much. We will now turn to Dr. Ira Helfand, who is a board-certified internist trained at Harvard and Albert Einstein Medical College and past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, which has been one of the leading groups for credible and very solid advocacy on a number of issues, including nuclear issues. So please go ahead, Dr. Helfand. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you. I actually want to just say, as I start, that I think Arjun's description of mess is exactly the right way to describe this. one of the things that you know, we're continuously asked when we're presenting to the press and to the public about the situations, what's happening. And one of the most important facts is that we don't know what's happening, and neither do the people who are running the show there. And that is just an enormously important aspect of this. We're 2 weeks out from the beginning of this accident, more than that, and the situation there is still chaotic, with a great deal of uncertainty as to what's gone on. You know, the discovery today of this intensely radioactive water in the tunnel near the number 2 reactor, don't know how it got there. Big question as to what exactly is going on and what it means in terms of the potential for future releases. So one of the things that I caution people when they talk about this is when they are discussing the potential health effects, the first thing that we have to start with is we don't know what's happening. We don't know how big the radiation exposures are ultimately going to be. But a few things we can say even at this point. One, it is very important to emphasize in this situation that the assurances that we're receiving from the industry and from some government officials, both in Japan and abroad, that the radiation levels that have been released so far are safe is just flat out unacceptable. There are lots of things we're not sure about radiation. One thing which there is very strong consensus at this point, there is no safe level of radiation. Beer 7 report of the National Academy of Sciences was really quite unequivocal about this, that at this point, a linear model of causality between radiation dose and cancer seems to be the one which best describes available data. There is no threshold level. Any exposure to radiation increases your risk of getting cancer. And when we talk about a dose being very, very small, it is perhaps appropriate, if in fact the dose is very small, to say that the health impact is going to be small, that the risk of any one individual getting cancer is going to be small. But that's different than saying this is a safe or acceptable dose of radiation. And we can't let the industry and its apologists in government get away with these just incorrect reassurances of the public. I think there are a couple of ways that we need to look at this. One is the difference between the dose per hour and the cumulative dose. And that is particularly important when we're talking about people who are going to be moving back into areas that are contaminated, or people who are in areas now which are getting some level of contamination. The dose per hour might be quite small, but cumulatively over time, that can end up being a very significant dose. Secondly, we need to consider the difference between the risk to an individual and the expected effect on the population. And this one, I think, is extremely important. At one point last week, there were many stories in the press saying that 100 millisieverts is the lowest dose at which there's a risk of cancer. Well, at 100 millisieverts, there's no risk. There's a small risk. But if you expose somebody to 100 millisieverts of radiation, they have a 1 in 100 risk of getting... Sorry, millisieverts is... 10 rems, yes, they have a 1 in 100 risk of getting cancer. That's relatively small, but if you expose 100 people to that, one of them is going to get cancer. If you expose 1,000 people, 10 of them are going to get cancer. And if you expose 1,000,000 people, you're going to have 10,000 cases of cancer. And that is the kind of obfuscation that goes on when we talk about these very low doses having a very low risk. It is very low for any one individual, but large numbers of people get exposed, and the cumulative effect therefore could be very significant. The other point which I think we need to look at is the difference between total body radiation and the ingestion or inhalation of radionuclides, which continue to irradiate the body from the inside. And this deals both with the longevity of the exposure, because many of these nuclides can continue to irradiate the body for a very long period of time, and also the intensity of the radiation at the local site where the particle lodges. So that, for example, if you inhale a very tiny particle of plutonium, your total body dose is going to be extremely small. But the dose to the lung tissue adjacent to which this particle lodges when you inhale it can be enough to cause cancer. Similarly, the better-known case of iodine, radioactive iodine, is actively absorbed by the body, as is iodine in general, and is concentrated in the thyroid, and it causes thyroid cancer. The dose that will cause the thyroid cancer is substantially less than the dose which, if given to your entire body, would put you at risk, would put you at higher risk for cancer. And so this distinction has to be clearly borne in mind. It's also significant for cesium and for strontium and for several other radioactive nuclei that have specific biological behaviors. Strontium is an analog of calcium.
Oh, good.
It gets treated like the body, by the body like calcium, gets incorporated into bone, and it has a radiological half-life of 29 years and a biological half-life of about 30 years. So that basically, 30 years down the road, your bone is still getting a half the dose of radiation every day that it was getting when you first incorporated this bit of strontium into your body. And because of that, even though your total body dose might be really very, very small, you have a significant risk of getting either leukemia or bone cancer. So I think those three points are the ones that from a health perspective, we've been trying to bring to this debate, and the ones that we need to bear in mind. The final point, which is not specifically a health-related one, but I think a generic point about this accident, is the one that I've alluded to before and that Arjun spoke to already, which is that this situation is far from being under control. There's already been an enormous amount of radiation released, and we have no idea where this is going to end. And the potential for much, much larger releases is clearly there. The potential for releases of plutonium from the number 3 reactor, which would have very specific and severe health impacts, is a very real possibility as well. So let me stop also so that we can have time for questions.
Thank you. Since you've both been succinct, I'm wondering, one of the issues that, if you can say anything useful, I don't know at this point, given all the unknowns, about proximity, about spread, given, say, current knowledge, and also perhaps worst-case scenario in terms of the rest of the nation there and elsewhere. Obviously, there's been a lot of the AMA today put out a release about panic about potassium iodide, et cetera, in the United States and other places in Asia and so forth. So if there's something, I know that's a question on a lot of people's minds as well.
Ira, do you want me to take the spread and severity of the accident?
Why don't you go first,
question,
and then
I'll let you deal with the U.S. thing,
sure.
If that's all right with you.
Sure.
The radioactivity already has spread globally, so in that respect, it is like Chernobyl. Radioactivity has been detected in the United States and also in Europe. The air concentrations are very, very low, and the concentrations, of course, in the vicinity of the plant have been much higher. The dose isolates that have been published and other information indicate that most of the radioactivity, or at least much of the radioactivity, has blown over the ocean. That's why the ocean, even quite far away from the plant, is quite contaminated. They've got a fair amount of contamination of the seawater, and I imagine, you know, of the plant life as well as fish in the ocean. I don't know how far out that radius extends, but probably tens of miles. The dose isolates are actually not in a circle, so they never are, and because the accident has gone on for so long, the contamination is kind of in irregular patterns. I think the contamination over Tokyo peaked a few days after the accident, also in radiological patterns, but it does extend tens of miles beyond the plant. In terms of worst case, the total amount of radioactivity in these seven sources, long-lived radioactivity, is much greater than Chernobyl. These are the total power of these four reactors is much greater than the 1,000 megawatts at Chernobyl, and because they're spent fuel pools with probably, I think, about 25 years worth of accumulated spent fuel for operating a one reactor equivalent. The long-lived radionuclides like cesium 137 would be particularly high. There's also, of course, some mixed oxide fuel. There's been a lot of focus on the mixed oxide plutonium fuel in reactor number 3, but so far as I understand, it was only 6% of the fuel. It was a test run for mixed oxide fuel, so While if there had been more, it may have affected the situation, but I think that's a piece of the situation that we're fortunate that they didn't have more mixed outside fuel in that. Some plutonium has been detected in small quantities outside in the soil near the reactors, according to news reports today.
And Dr. Halpin, did you have something?
Yeah, I think you'd asked a specific question about potassium iodide at this point, and in the United States, I think we can and should be reassuring to people that at the levels of iodine that have been detected, use of potassium iodide is not indicated, that the potential risks from using this improperly, the potential health problems associated with potassium iodide at this level, I think would be felt to outweigh any benefit. Again, not to say that there is no risk, but the risk to any one individual is extremely low, and therefore the risk of taking potassium iodide outweighs that. Again, this may change if there are further significant releases, but at this point, the use of potassium iodide does not appear to be necessary any place in the United States.
Thank you, and I think the other question that we should be addressed, or at least brought up, that comes up in many people's minds is the similarity or lack thereof of reactors and various safety factors in the reactors there versus ones here, and I'm wondering if either of you have any comments on that as well with the risk in the United States, for example.
The reactors in the United States and Japan and generally in the West are all of the same basic design. They're all light water reactors. They're various vintages, you know, so it's like gasoline-powered cars. They're all gasoline-powered. They all have a tank, you know, so they all have internal combustion engines, so the basic concept is the same. And the reason that's important is this whole process of meltdown, cooling by water, emergency core cooling, a large amount of radioactivity resident in the core where the heat needs to be carried away by cooling by water, that's all common. And then if you lose cooling, the fuel rods are made in the same way. They're made out of zirconium alloy, and zirconium reacts with steam when the fuel rods become uncovered because the water becomes steam. And that is an exothermic reaction. So that aggravates the meltdown problem, and at a certain point, at a high enough temperature, the zirconium will catch fire. So at that point, you get a very, very severe self-propagating fire that can happen in a spent fuel pool or in a reactor. Actually, because the spent fuel pool configuration is the way it is, it has a pretty good supply of oxygen, and so the spent fuel pool fire is a pretty significant danger. We have 23 reactors of about the same vintage, the Mark I design, where the spent fuel pool is sort of near the top of the reactor without a secondary containment building that has, that's very robust with 5-foot thick walls and so on. The pressurized water reactors are somewhat different in that they have the spent fuel pool outside, but the outside spent fuel pool does not have the same sort of 5-foot thick concrete robust containment structure, especially on the roof, and has been judged vulnerable to terrorism. Consequences of terrorist attacks were studied by Brookhaven in 1997. The reference is on our website and the thing I published on March 14th. The number of excess cancer deaths in a 500-mile radius estimated by Brookhaven and U.S. reactors ranged from a low of 1,900 in a severe accident, of course, to somewhat over 140,000, depending on how severe, where the reactor was, population density, and so on.
Dr. Halpin, do you have any comment as well?
Yeah, I think just to underline the point that Arjun made about the generic nature of the problem, there's been a lot of effort to downplay the possibility of a similar accident taking place here on the grounds that, quotes, our reactors are different. After Three Mile Island, the Russians were very confident that they would never have a Three Mile Island accident because their reactors were different. And they were correct. They did not have a Three Mile Island. They had a Chernobyl. And after Chernobyl, the Japanese were very confident that they could not have a Chernobyl-type accident because their reactors were different. They also were correct. They didn't have a Chernobyl. They had a Fukushima. We're being told now that our reactors are different. And in fact, as Arjun just points out, they're actually not that different. There may be some minor modifications that have taken place or that will take place as a result of this. But the generic, but that point, though, is still somewhat true. We're probably not going to have a Fukushima here in the United States. We will have something different. The point is not the specifics of this or that accident that have taken place in the past, but the simple fact that accidents can and will take place. When you have a technology that is this complicated, you cannot expect it to be perfect. But when you take this much radiation and pack it into a building upwind from large population centers, it has to be perfect. And that's the nub of the problem. We really have created a situation which requires us to be infallible, and we simply are not. That's the answer to the attempts to say that we can never have this kind of an accident here because our reactors are different.
Let me put a caveat and an explanation. The potential for severe accidents in these kind of reactors has been recognized since the 1950s in official reports of the Atomic Energy Commission. I think the first report was called WASH 740. And so that has been recognized. The vintages of reactors do matter, just like cars. You know, modern cars are safer than older ones because they have more safety features, they have more robust containments, and the probability may be lower. But we can get a perspective. We've had commercial reactors in the world now for over half a century, and we have had six major accidental reactor failures, three in Fukushima now, 3 miles away, Chernobyl, and perhaps forgotten by most people, 1957 accident in Britain, and also in a graphite-moderated reactor. All, you know, with different levels of consequences, but all major accidents.
Thank you. So, Erica, would we be time now to open up for some comments and questions?
Certainly. So thank you, and thank you for those presentations. I just want to remind everyone that if you do wish to make a comment or ask a question at this time, you're first going to need to unmute your line by pressing star 6, and just let me get us into that mode. So that will work when you do it. 1 second. Okay, so star 6 will unmute you. We do ask that you identify yourself before you make a comment, and if you can keep your remarks brief so that we have time to get to as many people as possible, that would be great. Also, particularly with the number of people on this call, when you're done asking your question, if you could again press star 6 to remute yourself, that will help us to keep excess noise down on the line as others speak. And a reminder that there's also the blog on the CHE website if you wish to try to post a comment or question there.
Thank you, and I would emphasize the blog if you wish to post links or that kind of thing or make a statement, you can do it there. I'm actually going to start with a question from the blog regarding Japan itself. Given all the unknowns, how much land surrounding the Fukushima complex will need to be abandoned and for how long? And, number two, how will the contaminated hardware and physical infrastructure at the reactor be managed? Do either of you know about those?
Well, it's unclear about the contamination of the land. I haven't seen soil measurements. Have you, Ira?
No, I have not seen soil measurements yet.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's clear that there's been a fair amount of deposition of radioactivity, but it's also clear that much or most of the radioactivity has blown over the ocean. And I think the habitability question will really be a pretty major one once this accident is under control. As I said, most of the cesium-137, which will probably dominate the habitability question, still hasn't been released, but there are varying estimates out there about how much has been released, and the upper limit estimates do rival Chernobyl, so it's unclear how much of that has been deposited and how far and what the weather patterns have been. I mean, we just don't have the measurements at this stage to be able to tell. So far as the mess in the reactors is concerned, they've got damaged fuel in all three reactors. They've probably got damaged fuel in three of the four spent fuel pools anyway. Reactor number one spent fuel pool, spent fuel may be okay. There's not a lot in there. And if you think about Three Mile Island, it took a very long time, even though it hadn't melted through. Here we're talking about at least one reactor, maybe two, whose containment has been compromised. Buildings that are extremely severely contaminated, it's going to take years, and I believe this site will certainly, it would be extremely imprudent to even try to use this site. I don't know about the two reactors that appear to have not been damaged, but I don't know, you know, what the radiological conditions would be. Today, it would appear radiological conditions very difficult because water has leaked from the turbine buildings, and now there are parts of the site outside of the buildings that are 100 rads per hour.
And one of the problems, I think, here is that much of this has gone into the ocean, and much of the radioactivity that is apt to leak out may go into the ocean. Certainly this water, which is intensely radioactive, the great concern now is it's going to get into the ocean. So it's not just a question of how much land will be uninhabitable, but how large a zone will have to be closed to fishing. And real concerns, I think, about how well we'll be able to monitor this, since once the radioactive material gets into the ocean, it is prone to distributing more broadly than if it were deposited on land. The land question is going to be very difficult, and of course, biggest part of the answer is we don't know yet fully how extensive the contamination is going to be because this isn't over yet. But even 6 days ago, the Department of Energy was showing maps with significant plume of radiation extending not just over the water but northwest from the reactor, so that outside of the evacuation zone, the ambient radiation level was at that point 12.5 millirads per hour. This is an air measurement, not a soil measurement, but if you're getting that kind of release, that kind of radiation outside of the evacuation zone, then I think there's a fairly good likelihood that the land there is going to turn out to have been significantly contaminated.
Well, one of the aspects of this accident that I think also, at least I had never thought of, was the amount of economic damage done in terms of all these parts and factories being shut down all over the world, whether it's electronics or and the shipping not being able to, not shipping companies not wanting to send their ships to Tokyo, which is quite far away. I think a lot of the question will not only revolve around habitability, but how Japan can reestablish itself and have the wherewithal for rebuilding a much larger devastated infrastructure in the whole tsunami earthquake area, not just the nuclear affected area.
Thank you. Related question to discussed earlier, but from the blog as well. Could you comment on the risk of birth defects for infants to be born in Japan in the next few months, and also conjecture on the chance of increased radiation exposure to those in utero on the west coast of the United States? There's a lot of conflicting information online about this. Any comment there?
And in terms of the situation on the west coast of the United States, again, I think that the amount of radiation that we're seeing at this point is extremely low, and the impact would therefore be expected to be very small, meaning that the risk for any woman who is pregnant at this time is probably very, very, very low. It does not mean that it's zero. It does not mean this is an acceptable situation, but it means that a pregnant woman on the West Coast should probably continue to do all the things that a pregnant woman should normally do to protect her health and the health of the baby that she's carrying, but nothing different. In Japan, the situation is probably significantly different, certainly in the area closest to the plant. They do seem to be monitoring the radioactivity fairly closely. The radiation that was present in the tap water in Tokyo last week, obviously very disturbing. Those doses were considered to be too low for infants. They were clearly also, too high for infants. They were clearly also too high for pregnant women, and put those fetus is at risk as well.
I had one soil measurement, and there have been soil measurements. I'd forgotten about them. I'm looking at one now, so if I might amend my previous answer, Steve. There's been a hot spot measured a few tens of kilometers away from the site of 163,000 becquerels per kilogram. That's a pretty very high level of contamination. But it is a hot spot, probably created by rainout, but not a good sign for the future.
And the, another question, there's been much discussion about the risk of drinking water, I suppose in Japan, but how about showering or bathing in this water, or doing laundry in it and so forth? Is that a problem?
Well, the levels that were reported in Tokyo, I mean, that those are the only levels I've seen when they issued the warning that infants should not drink. And unfortunately, it was not differentiated by radionuclide, so it's very hard to tell, because standards in the United States are by radionuclide or by dose from beta and photon emitters. And so we didn't get either of those measurements. Hard to calculate dose if you don't know the radionuclide. So I think the water contamination, at least far away from the site, has gone down to very low levels, even in Japan. But I don't know the situation closer to the site. I imagine the water is contaminated and that people are not drinking it. Probably contaminated in some place, at least over the drinking limit.
If it was, would showering or doing laundry be an issue?
Well, showering will suspend aerosols, and you do have some inhalation dose from that. And how much inhalation dose you get will depend on the concentration. We don't have the numbers. And so I imagine there is some contamination. But I think that pathway is probably less important than other pathways, notably food, I would suspect. I don't imagine that nearby in the evacuation centers people are taking lots of showers, because I don't think the facilities are there, you know, for frequent showers in nearby.
Regarding measurement, actually, is anyone taking real-time measurements of radiation exposure at various points on the compass at 10, 20, 50, 100 miles away? Such data seems to be needed to gauge the actual exposure of people. And is it being gathered, and would that be done here in the United States in the case of such an event?
Well, there are worldwide data being gathered, and data being gathered in Japan. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization has gathered data. The EPA has a number of monitoring stations. Unfortunately, some of them are not functional, and some of them are sort of manually functional, which is they collect data and report them, but then they have to be manually sorted before you can be sure that they're right. And I don't know exactly what's going on with those monitors, and I don't have an explanation in front of me from the EPA, but the question has been raised as to what is wrong and what the data need to be manually sorted. So there are lots of measurements. Unfortunately, a lot of them are not published, and governments are playing it pretty close to the vest, but Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization has published data, and the DOE has published a summary aerial survey data. I can post the URL on our website for people to be able to see that, or send you for posting on your website the slide. It shows the slides. It shows a sort of a narrow band to the northwest of Fukushima that is a high radiation zone extending 10 or 15 kilometers out.
Arjun, what date do you have that from? I've not been able to get that data beyond March 19th.
Yes, I think it was a aerial surveys. I don't have beyond March 19th either. I think we have the same slideshow, Ira.
Yes.
It was aerial surveys that were done over 3 days. I'm reasonably sure that there are more current measurements, but it goes out about 15 miles, actually.
Yeah, and that data was kind of disturbing, and it's pretty old at this point, meaning that either new data has been collected since then that hasn't been released, but they stopped collecting it, and it would obviously be very good to get that data from the time period since the 19th.
I think an FOIA has been filed for the data, because U.S. government data, and I know the Japanese are collecting data, and currently they're making more data public, but because it is incompletely published, it's hard to interpret. And of course, it's hard to keep up here, because only some of it is in English, and it's hard to get everything that is published in Japan.
From Dr. Bob Gould, also with PSR, would either speaker like to comment on the safety of fault-associated California reactors such as San Onofre and Diablo Canyon here?
I heard. You want to take it? Should I?
Why don't you talk about that one? I'll talk about the ones on the East Coast.
Okay. Well, you know, the it's the same sort of similar situation on the West Coast, the authorities at Diablo Canyon and San Onofre have said that they're not as vulnerable to tsunamis. The seawall at Diablo Canyon is higher and so on. I personally think that the U.S. authorities, both power plant people, Nuclear Energy Institute, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, I'm especially upset with what some of the things that are on the site of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, reissuing of the license of Vermont Yankee and all that, have been too quick on the draw to say everything's all right. We're going to do a review, but we already know everything's all right and everything's safe, and let's go ahead with the loan guarantees. And we already know that we don't need to revisit the earthquake situation in California. I think, fortunately, the NRC is going to revisit the earthquake situation more seriously, at least so it seems. I worry about the spent fuel pools a lot, and because they're not as robust as the reactors, and people don't pay attention to them because, well, historically they haven't been a source of concern, but I have to say after 9/11, spent fuel pools became the focus of my concern because they're more vulnerable in so many ways, and I worry about the spent fuel pools in earthquake-prone areas in the United States.
And I certainly understand Bob's concern about the reactors on the West Coast, which are obviously very close to known active fault lines. It turns out that the NRC, their listing says that the most vulnerable reactor in the United States to earthquake activity is Indian Point, north of New York, because of the way it's built, which is that it was designed to withstand a magnitude 3 earthquake, and it's now believed that the faults in that area, which there are actually, are capable of generating a magnitude 7 earthquake. And the second most vulnerable is the Pilgrim plant south of Boston for the same kinds of reasons. It was built to withstand a lesser earthquake than is now believed to be possible in that area. And I think it just kind of underlines the ubiquity of these problems and the fact that we just don't always, we're fighting the last war. We don't think ahead, and I'm not faulting individuals. This is a sort of a systems problem. We can't anticipate every problem that can come up. But in this particular situation, Indian Point is sort of the poster child for a reactor that shouldn't be built where it is. The 50-mile evacuation zone that the U.S. has proposed for Fukushima, if applied at Indian Point, would require, in the event of an accident there, would require the evacuation of 17 million people. And no one has ever done anything like that. No one knows how to evacuate 17 million people. I'm an ER doctor. We do not have disaster plans any place for that kind of an eventuality. Just kind of underscores the unexpected nature of the problems that we are apt to encounter with our nuclear reactors.
Thank you. We've got more questions on the blog for people to look at. We may come back to those, but I want to give people who may not be on a computer. So if there are people on the phone who want to ask a quick question.
Yeah, hi, this is Pat Hilgard in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Just going back to how to actually work on the problems in Japan, Washington Post had a big question this morning about what happened to all the Japanese robots and how come they're not doing anything on this problem, and something that said that the workers that were trying to go in and do something can only work it for 40 seconds at a time, plus they don't know where all that stuff is leaking out of and getting out of the plant, going down into the groundwater, and that all this water that they keep pouring in the top to cool things down either is going away or is getting hot and they need to put it someplace, and where are they going to put all of that seawater, and then the fact that all that salt is probably going to be corroding things out and they have to pump all that out and put in fresh water from whence, I don't know. And so I does anybody know enough about any of this stuff to say how could they even figure out what's going on? How can they actually work on the problem however long it takes to do it?
But the situation is starting to remind me of taking care of a very, very complicated ICU patient where every day something new goes wrong. And you try to figure out what's going on with the patient, but you're limited because you can't do certain tests because the patient's too sick to have them, and because some questions in medicine, you just aren't able to answer them yet. And I think that's kind of the situation there with, you know, these multiple different reactors and spent fuel ponds all having all kinds of problems, and we don't know what's going on in detail practically with any of them. That's the bottom line. We don't know what's happening there.
Well, a large part of the problem is, you know, reactors and control rooms depend on electricity and instrumentation, and there's been significant amount of damage to the sensors. They aren't sending the signals anymore. It's very hard to work in the control rooms. They have some. It's partly functional, partly not functional. You've described a very difficult situation and why there's been so much stumbling. And seawater, of course, was never supposed to be injected into reactors, but they had no other source of water. So they injected seawater, and that's, you know, apparently causing its own problems, and it's going to be a very difficult thing to deal with. They've got, you know, various stages of meltdown in significant elements among these seven. It's not clear. It's probably at least five out of the seven seem to have had significant fuel damage, if not all seven. And so the problem is, once you put water and once you have to do this emergency cooling in a boiling water reactor, you have steam that builds up, and then you got to vent the pressure. And currently, actually, they seem to have that under control, and they're not venting excess steam, so that source of radioactivity seems to have stopped. This is part of the reason nobody knows how this is going to evolve. I mean, they can pump the water out of these reactor buildings so workers can go in and not get radiation burns while they are trying to fix things, but they don't have any empty tanks in which they can put this water. So it's, you know, it's a large amount of water. So there is a situation that is extremely difficult for which there are no simple answers, or even evident answers.
Thank you. Do we have another question from
yes.
caller?
This is Dr. Roseanne, Whidbey Island. Short of a significant accident like these, what risk and what exposures are we having in the United States from low-level releases from ongoing reactor function? steam pipes corrode and leak, and things like that happen all the time.
You mean reactors here in the United States?
Yes.
Okay. Anybody want to answer that?
Well, the routine limit, they're supposed to keep the radiation doses to below certain norms, and I can tell you what those norms are and make measurements to make sure they're not exceeding them. The EPA standards for nuclear fuel cycle facilities are 25 millirem or 0.25 millisieverts to the whole body or to any organ except for the thyroid, where the limit is 75 millirem. And the NRC has a supplemental guide that radiation doses should be kept below 5 millirem or 4 millirem, something like that. The operators do measure radioactivity releases and effluents, gaseous and liquid effluents, but I think the measurements are not that adequate because, for instance, they measure periodically and not continuously. They discharge tritium via the stacks. Most reactors do. So it comes down in the rainwater, but they don't measure the rainwater. And it has been acknowledged by at least one person in the industry that when you have a discharge event via the stack and a rainstorm at the same time, local water can become very contaminated. We don't regulate individual drinking water wells. I do believe that the routine doses are generally well within the EPA standards, but I don't believe our measurement and reporting and regulatory protocols are very adequate.
There's another, just if maybe you could briefly comment on prophylaxis, I guess we'd call it. A lot of attention being paid to exposure to only one iodine-131, but there are possibly many other elements, cesium, strontium, plutonium, and are there other potentially useful prophylaxis, the ones listed here, Prussian blue for cesium-137, aluminum phosphate for strontium-90, and calcium and zinc for plutonium. Is there anything worth remarking there?
Well, Prussian blue can be useful if there is a significant cesium contamination. It's certainly not something that anyone should be doing now. But yes, it can. It can help to decrease the body burden of cesium-137. I'm not familiar with the use of
aluminum phosphate or calcium or zinc.
Zinc for yeah. plutonium. I mean, the main route of ingestion for plutonium is inhalation, and I'm not aware of any good way of really working on decreasing that. You can use chelating agents after the fact, but they're of somewhat limited utility given the kinds of tissue that it gets deposited in.
Yeah, I mean, extreme cases like in nuclear weapons sites, chelating agents have been used, but they have, as Ira said, indicated they have their own side effects. And the only other sort of relatively straightforward thing is exposure to tritium and drinking lots of water, because, tritiated water will go out faster out of the system if you drink lots of water, but it doesn't deal that well with organically bound tritium, which is, of course, quite a different animal altogether.
And another question here, to what degree are terrorist attacks on nuclear plants factored into the safety analysis, both in the U.S. and internationally? If an airliner loaded with fuel flies into a nuclear plant or cooling pool, what happens?
Very bad things.
Yes.
the industry...
A mess.
The industry claims that the reactors will withstand even the kind of attack that took place at the World Trade Center. I don't think that there's any data really to support that. Arjun may be familiar with studies that I'm not, but the studies that I've looked at in the years immediately after September 11th indicated that this really had never been studied before, that specific scenario, and there was no indication that a reactor vessel could sustain, maintain itself against that kind of an attack. Clearly of much greater concern are the spent fuel ponds, because the containment there is really quite flimsy. It's really like a normal building in most cases, and they are extremely vulnerable to terrorist attack. And I think it's really quite extraordinary that there hasn't been a terrorist attack to date at one of these places.
Well, the National Academies actually did a study of the problem of terrorist vulnerabilities on spent fuel pools, and they recommended things like sprays in case of fire, because once you have a loss of coolant, there is some risk of fire, especially in dense storage configurations that have been allowed. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission essentially has disregarded the central recommendations. They also noted dry storage is a lot safer. And in our opinion, meaning in the number of groups that have written and suggested that there be hardened on-site storage, dry storage of as much spent fuel as possible, the older cool stuff, it would be much safer, but the NRC is quite reluctant to impose costs. There was a petition to the NRC after 9/11 to consider aircraft crashes, and the NRC, I haven't read the NRC ruling itself, but this is a little bit secondhand, but from somebody who was involved in that process, that the NRC not only refused to consider it, there have been claims made that reactors can withstand terrorist attacks, but NRC's position is that emergency management would take care of it. Now, if you look at the Mark I reactors, where there have been three buildings sort of largely destroyed by hydrogen explosions with the spent fuel pools right there near the top of the building, we have 20-odd reactors like that, and I have to question if a hydrogen explosion from hydrogen inside the building could destroy it like that. It's very questionable in my mind, although I haven't done the calculation, that it could withstand a severe aircraft crash. And in these buildings, of course, the spent fuel pool is inside. A spent fuel pool is inside the reactor building, not outside. So both sets of reactors have terrorism vulnerabilities. They would undoubtedly be able to withstand some kinds of terrorist attacks, but the NRC says that new reactors should be designed to withstand aircraft and aircraft attacks and made at least one designer of the AP-1000 go back to the drawing board. So I don't know what that implies about existing reactors. The NRC has not been forthcoming, and more and more they classify stuff, they say, for national security reasons. We can't reveal this.
You know, that would imply that if it's necessary for passengers to take off their shoes before they get on a plane to guarantee our safety, perhaps there ought to be no-fly zones enforced around nuclear reactors. And obviously the industry would be very loath to have that happen because it would dramatize so clearly how dangerous these plants are. But that really is the case. There should be.
I believe there are some restrictions. You know, I don't keep track of this aspect of the business, but I wouldn't be sure that there aren't some restrictions. At least there were immediately after 9/11.
I believe they were lifted, Arjun.
They were lifted?
They were imposed right after 9/11, and they were lifted subsequently.
Yeah, I haven't.
Thank you both. We're running out of time here, but I really want to take advantage of the last, we've got 90 seconds or so. If both of you wanted to make at least one statement briefly on what the most important measure you think needs to be taken at this point to make things better at this point, if you had a policy recommendation that's most urgent.
I think there needs to be a moratorium on new plants. There should be no extension of licenses of plants whose licenses are coming due. And I think we need a master plan for phasing out the plants that we have in place. This accident has shown they are simply too dangerous for us to rely on, and we can't shut them all down overnight, but we need to have a plan for doing that over time and as quickly as possible.
I agree with IR on that, and the only amendment I would say, you know, we've got a significant threat from coal-fired power plants. I've done a book, Carbon Free, Nuclear Free. You can download it free from our website. The one thing I would add is the spent fuel pools really are too full in this country for the most part because of this re-racking and dense storage, and the risks are unnecessarily high, and they ought to be emptied into hard and dry storage. We know how to do it. The technology exists. The costs are not great compared to the profits. And this is something that we ought to, you know, urge the NRC to make sure that it happens with reasonable dispatch, because they're avoidable with risks from existing spent fuel pools.
Well, thank you. And thank you both very much. This has been just excellent and disturbing at the same time. But you've both been very succinct and, I'd say, very understandable. So thank you both for joining us, and to everybody else who joined us to listen in and participate. And hopefully the current incident will resolve itself in the best possible way, given everything that's going on. And I will now turn it back to Erica to say goodbye. And again, thank you all.
Thank you, Steve. A quick reminder to everyone that an MP3 recording of the call will be available soon on the CHEA website. I should be able to have that up no later than tomorrow morning. CHEA currently has two partnership calls scheduled for April. The first is on April 15th and is titled Diabetes and Obesity, Evaluating the Science on Chemical Contributors. And the second call will take place on April 20th and features Carl Craner, who is the author of Legally Poisoned, How the Law Puts Us at Risk from Toxicants. You can register for both of those on the CHEA website. And with that, I'd just like to thank everyone for joining today's call and wish you a good day. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.